Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much, but when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hey, before we get the show started, I wanted to let you know we are giving away a bunch of brand new Black Magic gear.
Yeah, cameras, switchers, DaVinci Resolve licenses, a bunch of awesome stuff. So stay tuned to learn how you can enter to win free gear from Black Magic, and we're going to tell you all about it later on in this episode. Now cue the music. Hey everyone, welcome to the 225th episode of Just Shoot It, a podcast about filmmaking, screenwriting, and directing. This episode is brought to you by patrons Andrea Nelson and Holly Peterson. I'm Warren Kaplan.
And I'm Matt Unlow. Today, we've got a Matt and Oren episode. It's just Oren and I talking about all of the things that we've been working on and also digging in on what it means to be a COVID-friendly director in this age of the pandemic. So we're talking all about our experiences shooting remotely, travel jobs, pitching on things, and everything in between. We're going to talk about some news items as well. We're digging in on the nature of being a director during the COVID-19 pandemic. So it's going to be a good one.
Yeah. I mean, I guess there was like this long time where we just thought, as soon as this is over, this is going to be our next move. And it's become pretty clear that there isn't an official over that's going to happen like this year. Even if a vaccine comes out in the fall, people still, obviously a lot of people won't take the vaccine. So the vaccines might only be effective for some people. Even like a vaccine, which seems like an easy like on-off switch of us being able to go back to work or testing or whatever. If you could test everyone in 5 minutes at every point, like none of that stuff is realistic for this year. And especially now with schools in LA not opening, it's going to be wild, man. I think at least until next year. And, you know, going by the Matt Enlow school of thought, like even if things got better around November, it would be too late for the rest of the year because there's people like everything shuts down, right?
Right. Well, you know, so just to kind of give everyone context for where we are in time as recording this, it is July 15th. And so, you know, we all kind of went into various forms of lockdown in March, right? Like mid-March. And so it's been kind of a while now. I think I'm on day 125 of...
Did you really calculate it?
Yeah, we keep track. Chrissy has like a little... we have a little sign and we change the number every day. You know, like those like cute marquees?
Yeah. Does it have like a Far Side cartoon on every page?
I wish. You know, Gary Larson is
he's doing back.
Comics. Yeah.
Except he's like very careful to not say he's back.
Yeah, yeah.
But he's drawing like with the tablet, I think, and
I think doing
pretty amazing artwork.
I was a pretty diehard Far Side fan as a kid. Yeah. Anyway, yeah. So I think we all thought that we would be back to work by now. And, you know, I have always said that 4th of July is kind of my dividing. That's like the beginning, the first half of the year and the second half of the year basically is predicated on the 4th of July, because that's kind of around where summer vacations pivot. So like if an ad executive is planning on taking their kids to Disney World in July, then they're probably going to get all of their jobs done before that. And then they'll go on their trip and then they'll come back and, you know, start pitching on things and it'll trickle down to us. And, you know, by the end of July, we're beginning to work again, basically, is the idea. And that's anecdotal based off of like a couple years of keeping track of everything. And so that's not a hard and fast rule, but mentally it's, I've kind of always been like, okay with taking July pretty easy. And here we are mid July. And, you know, we continue to set, records in terms of COVID cases here in Los Angeles. So,
yeah,
it's pretty demoralizing. But that's not what we're here to talk about. We're talking about, the reality of this being a part of our lives for a while and how we are coping and attacking it.
Yeah. And this is not something that we haven't talked about on the podcast before and that other podcasts haven't treaded. And you probably talk about, you know, if you listen to this podcast, you've probably talked about this type of thing with your friends and family as well. But I do think, to your point, Matt, that on July 15th, we are looking at what us as directors should be doing much differently than we were on April 15th, which is probably around when we did that COVID director episode where we talked to a bunch of different directors about what they're doing.
Yeah, back then we were all just watching Tiger King and, you know, trying to get toilet paper and not thinking that this was going to be a long-term situation.
Yeah, I think across the board, the directors we spoke to were saying, you know, we're working on writing, we're trying to figure out had to make our shoots a little bit smaller, and we're eager to get back to them. But no one was actually talking about production during pandemic. And I got to admit, I was one of those people that was seeing all these people on Facebook and social media trying to create these, like, you know, like Ira Rosenzweig, who's been on our podcast, created this thing called Crew in a Box, which is a box you mail to someone. You literally open it up, mm-hmm. and it has lights come out of it, microphone mm-hmm. comes out of it, a teleprompter comes out of it. There's a, I think, a Blackmagic camera in there, some other like yeah. kind of 4K or 6K camera.
There's certainly like that kind of inner circle of people trading test case scenarios of how to do this sort of work remotely. You know, like Sandwich did a great behind the scenes video on how they did a remote shoot for Slack, actually, I think is what it was. But yeah, there's a lot of different companies trying to prove like, hey, everyone, we've got the solution to make content for you, brand or TV network or whatever, so that they can stay afloat. And it's certainly like a survival tactic for these companies that have more overhead and, you know, their PPP loan, you know, only goes so far and all of that stuff. Whereas as individuals, I think it's a slightly different deal, but I think we're all in that headspace now of like, well, we've got at least the second half of this year to look at. Like, I'm not just going to write two more screenplays. That can't be the plan, you know? And look, maybe it is, but like, that doesn't seem sustainable.
Right. And the point I was going to make was that I was thinking that was a waste of time because I thought as soon as they got their products off the ground, the whole pandemic would be over and we'd be back at work. And all this time and money and effort they'd spent on remote shooting was all for none. But I guess one of the things that I thought we could talk about is just either our own stories of remote shooting, of self-shooting, of auditioning to, you know, pitching on jobs, and also about other stories we've heard of. Because, mm-hmm. you know, our friends at Sawhorse have more or less been shooting nonstop for the last month.
And I think they're a great example of a style of content that we have seen bubble up over the last few months of webcams, basically, is kind of what it boils down to. And sometimes they're a little more technically evolved and sometimes it's a phone or something like that. But basically a consumer grade camera that a host or actors are addressing directly. It's kind of like the new version of a lifestyle piece. You know, it's like the commercial that's like voiceover of like, in these uncertain times, cut to like people on Skype talking to each other, you know.
Right.
And they're doing more, Sawhorse is doing more like live event style stuff. It's like the reunion of Parks and Rec sort of world that they're really orchestrating. So it's a lot of producing, but no one, my point is that no one is using a professional grade camera.
No, I'd say that what you just said, at least in regards to Sawhorse, was true like 1 to 2 months ago, but they're sending a camera person, you know, with a microphone to someone, to an actor's house. They're shooting on Canon C300s. They're shooting on Sony's, I mean, they might have done some Red Alexa shoots, you know, Yuki.
But real cameras is what you're getting at. Yeah.
Yeah. He just shot something on a C500.
Your point is, though, is that it's evolved, basically. Now they're sending a few bodies, basically.
Yeah. And I am seeing a lot is like celebrities or influencers having mini crews coming to their houses.
Mm-hmm.
And so I've had like kind of three examples of shoots, and I think the order that they're in kind of correlates to the time in the pandemic that they belong to. I've probably mentioned them all on the podcast, but I had one totally remote shoot. The actress that was in it actually lives like two blocks away from me, but you know, we weren't allowed to send anyone to her house. And not only that, and this was for Viacom, they had a company mandate that you couldn't even ask a crew member to leave their house. Like you couldn't mm-hmm. say like, oh, can you go buy this thing at Target? Even mm-hmm. though Target was open and it was like legal, you know?
Right, right.
But I think they've relaxed it a little bit since then. I think they're allowed to send like runners and things like that.
Mm-hmm. But basically they don't want to have any sort of liability, basically.
Yeah. So we could ship stuff. So we shipped all the art in like 12 separate bins to the actress's house. We sent her an iPhone 11 Pro with like a stand. We sent her two lights and a boom mic. And I think that's it, you know, product, of course.
Mm-hmm.
And for that one, it was all over Zoom. It was shot on the iPhone. And the idea about the iPhone being twofold. One, that there's an app that's installed on it that basically lets us see everything as it's being shot in super high, in like 4K quality. And the other thing, of course, being that almost everyone knows how to use one to shoot it.
Mm-hmm. Right.
I personally was fighting to use like a Blackmagic camera or even like a DSLR or something. I lost that battle, but the next production after me won it.
Oh, really? That's so funny.
Yeah.
Because I maybe would have advocated for the phone. I think phones look really great, and I think the point of, if you've got a single performer who's also your entire crew, managing their stress levels becomes maybe the most important resource that you're dealing with. Because if they get fed up or if they don't, like, it's a finite amount of energy that they can expend being telegenic and funny and bright on camera and also acquiescing to all of the little tweaks that you have for lighting and blocking and all of that stuff.
Right.
And so if you can make the camera part a little easier and maybe get away with making a few more adjustments as a result, if that's the trade-off, I think I'm probably willing to make that. I don't know.
I see that. And, you know, in the end, one of the reasons I didn't fight that hard for it is because of what you just said. But so first of all, we had a tech scout day, we called it, where we set up all the lights and the art and the phones mm-hmm. and stuff the day before the shoot to get, you know, so the client's not waiting for us to do that. And so on that day, whether it was an iPhone or a Blackmagic camera or whatever, Sony A7S, we
could have matter. Yeah, yeah.
We could have done all the settings. And the thing is, I totally agree with you for a specific type of shoot. If the shoot is like in a very bright house with a lot of daylight or in a backyard or, you know, somewhere mm-hmm. else, and Matt Pollack was on the podcast and talked about this, the iPhone 11 looks amazing outdoors with a lot of sun. Mm-hmm. But as soon as you're closing all the blinds and lighting a room by yourself, the sharpening, the contrast, and even the exposure, which is like pretty much auto-exposed the whole time. I mean, I know you can lock it if you know how to do it, but explaining to our
also
actor,
locking the exposure, are you using Filmic Pro or are you using the actual
camera? It's more or less the built-in camera, but it's wrapped around this other program called Cinebody, which is what automatically uploads it.
And is anyone, except for the actor, able to adjust the Cinebody settings at all? Like, could you or a DP type lock exposure, for instance, or adjust exposure?
No, not on the iPhone through that program, but I do believe that some cameras like the Blackmagic do let you have remote capabilities of those sorts.
Yeah, because that would be, if it's not on the actor's plate anymore, then that's a different deal entirely. And also, I think it's really tricky to self-shoot with the iPhone and do a focus or exposure lock, because like you have to have the subject in front of the camera, in front of the lens, in order for you to lock onto it.
Right. And you know what I did? We had like the easel that was the same height as the actress. And then when I did it myself at home, I had my iPad in selfie mode behind my phone that basically served as a mirror. I think you're the one that might have said, like, why don't you just use a mirror?
I did. Yeah.
But even seeing your screen with like many of those cameras, like a Sony A7S, I believe, or like a Canon C500 or something, you can flip the screen. Mm-hmm. So you can see what you're, how you're framed. So, you know, I think there's pluses and minuses, but at the end of the day, the iPhone, I don't think it looks good in interior lit shot with one light, you know, especially when you're going for kind of like beauty lighting and stuff. So
all of which is to say, I think that there is a distinct learning curve. In the same way that, like, you know, picking a crew size and a camera and the lens package, all that stuff, we have all of that experience. So we can say, okay, I know what we're shooting and I'm going to adapt our shooting style and get this gear to match what I'm aiming for. And now with this extra layer of remote shooting and, like, being able to, you know, some cameras you can control remotely and some cameras you can't and all of this stuff, how easy is it on the performer to self-operate, all of that stuff becomes a big blind spot for us, whereas we used to be able to bring in an area of expertise that, like, would guide and you would be, that we could guide basically a production into the exact right thing. That's part of our job, right? And so now we have to learn a new way of doing things.
Yeah. I will say the one thing that I did not think suffered was, like, the actor-director relationship, because we... we're like literally the way you and I are looking at each other over Google Hangouts right now. This is how we were. So I felt like I had her attention and she had my attention and we were looking at each other and talking about what she just did. And then we did another take, you know?
I believe that. That makes sense. Yeah.
And we're like kind of looking at close-ups of each other's faces. I mean, everyone else is listening. There is not like a lot of parallel processing. Like while we're talking, the art director can't be like adjusting things, you know?
Right. So that was my next question, actually, is have you done a shoot where there is a DP on set?
Well, so my second shoot was the one in Kentucky that I've, you know, all about. And that one was...
But for listeners at home, Oren flew out to Kentucky, shot with a small crew indoors overnight. But it was a small team. Everyone's masked up and all of that.
Yeah, and indoors, but it's a supermarket. So it's like a big open space. Everyone wore masks the entire time, except for the actors, took them off right before we rolled and put them on after we rolled. And did I talk to you about that controversy about whether we have, because it's in a supermarket, which is a public place, there was a question of, should our actors be wearing masks in the commercial?
Mm-hmm. I can't remember if we talked about it on the show or not. Ultimately, though, you just put a bug at the bottom that was a disclaimer that said, hey, this is...
Yeah, like check local regulations, you know, in regards to you might have to be masked. Yeah. And part of the reason it was a question is because the ads are supposed to air in July. And so there was this question, like, will we still be needing to wear masks in supermarkets in July? And everyone thought probably, but we don't know for sure. And if the answer is no, it's going to be kind of funny.
Not even funny. Remind you of something upsetting.
Yeah.
There's a reason we don't have a bunch of like commercial set at funerals.
Right. You know? But now, you know, the 3 or 4 weeks afterwards, I am starting to see a lot of commercials where people are wearing masks. Anyway, that one, the most dangerous thing I did, in my opinion, was at lunchtime, I was probably like 4 or 5 feet
you
away from the
DP. You spit in everyone's food.
Oh, yeah. But I always do.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, you're like, welcome to Los Angeles.
Yeah. And they're like, this is not Los Angeles. But otherwise, we're all masked. We all touched the cameras. I mean, I was touching everything. Everyone touched everything. It was kind of right at that time where people were starting to realize that surfaces aren't like the main way that people are spreading COVID. Mm-hmm. But everyone was sanitizing a lot, washing their hands. So that shoot went well. I mean, the most difficult part of that, I mean, A, we had a smaller crew. Like, there was no script supervisor. There was a lot less people on set, which maybe slowed us down. We only had a 2-person art team in a supermarket where everything you look at is a giant brand that's not really a big enough art team. But one of the interesting things that I didn't think about was even though we're in together, the communication is kind of hard when you don't see each other's lips. Like, you're like, hey, can you move that, you know, that light, like, 3 inches to the left? It's in the frame. And they're like,
all of a sudden, that's just brr, 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 brr.
Yeah, that, and also there's no lips to help give, like, ground the thing. Everyone has to listen so well that, like, the noise levels make a difference. And we were, you know, when you're losing time and you're running and you're like, can you do this while we do this and set that up while you're, and people are just, like, missing pieces of direction left and right. So,
yeah. Did you consider wearing a walkie at all?
No.
I hate walkies for a long time. Most directors hate walkies, and I would say that most of the time I do as well. But then, on Ellen, everyone was on walkie all the time. And when I needed to, when I only would be able to shoot it once because it was a surprise or something like that, and I needed to communicate with my camera ops.
I mean, that was hidden camera, pretty much.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
Oh yeah, yeah. Like, you got to do that.
So, but.
But you're not on walkie with, like, the gaffer or, like, the
I started going on to the main crew channel all the time, so I knew what was happening all of the time. I could, like, call things in advance. I could, you know, speak to people. Like, I felt like, oh, now I have a superpower. Instead of shouting to everyone, I know everything that's happening all the time and can communicate with them much more effectively.
Yeah, but then you also have to hear, like, oh, PAs, we need a few more chairs over here at...
Doesn't bother me. Doesn't bother me
or whatever.
With the big caveat that, like, I'm not rehearsing with an actor during that time. You know, the downtime is different when it's something where you're not working with actors.
Yeah. The only time I ever use a walkie is if either I'm talking to an actor that's in a car and I'm not in the car, or I'm talking to camera operators for something like what you're talking about, or if we're just on it, like, on a big location, like you're shooting on the studio lot, like big location, you just
can't have
walkies.
No matter how loud you shout, it doesn't help. Yeah,
and I'm not especially loud as it is.
Yeah.
I don't know if I talked about this on the podcast, but I have we have this little bubble pod, whatever, quarantine, whatever you want to call it, here in LA.
I don't think I want to call it a quarantine.
Okay,
I'll go. Pod is fine. I like a pod.
A cohort, some people call them.
I like that. I don't mean to... No disrespect.
I don't have fun with it. We call it the pod, but... Yeah.
It's very confusing for me.
Yeah, sorry about that. But we have rules for ourselves, and one of the rules is you're not allowed to fly anywhere. And we, by the way, we don't, like, really... It's not that we're all hanging out together, but our kids are playing together and touching each other, you know? So, like, within physical contact of each other. And so I flew to Kentucky. So when I came back...
there was a tribunal. You had to...
Yes, there was. You know. And they decided I had to quarantine for 10 days and get 2 negative COVID test results. But I got my first test the day after I flew back. And then they decided that that was too early, even if I did get COVID, for me to get a positive test result. So I had to get a third test on day
3 10. 3 out of 5 is not bad.
So, yeah, so that was kind of crazy. But it did give me a little bit of, like, alone time during my quarantine to really start working on some skills that I wanted to work on, which we'll talk about in a minute. I just wanted to mention the third shoot I have, which just keeps getting pushed farther and farther down the road right now. It was supposed to be July 22nd. Now it's August 4th. We'll see if it actually ends up happening. But it's with an influencer, a Twitch influencer. And we were going to... From conception of the whole concept and the shot list and everything, we were basically making a plan that she could shoot on her own at home. We could send a tiny crew to her house, or we could shoot on a stage, which is, like, really what I wanted to do.
Right. All of the plans at once. You're running in parallel 3 different ways.
Yeah. But, you know, as you're talking, this job has, like, 5 clients on it. So as you're talking to everyone and pitching to everyone and trying to change things and saying, you need this shot and you need this shot and you need this tone and you need this plug. Like, well, we couldn't do a little camera move, or we could do a pan, or we could do a rack focus, or we can do some fast cuts, or we'll light it in a way where you'll notice this. Like, as soon as you start talking about that type of stuff, like, the self-shooting kind of goes out the window.
Yeah. Yeah. Really, self-shooting works for a very specific style that, like, has to be written for, you know? And as soon as you want something that stands out in the, you know, media landscape, you know, there just has to be experts and specialists there to help execute.
Well, let me ask you, if you were an actor, Would you feel safer if a 3-person crew came to your house, dressed it, set up a couple lights, mics, and filmed you in your house, and they were masked and gloved? Or would you feel safer going to a big stage, you know, like a like one of those giant stages with like, you know, 30-foot high ceilings that's 50 by 80 feet or whatever.
Yeah, a sound stage, like a real sound stage.
Yeah, a real sound stage with big elephant doors and things. And somebody had built your room, like the room that I'm looking at over Google Hangouts right now, 4 walls, pretty much 3 walls, a door, a fake window, and dressed it, maybe even built it a little bit bigger than your room. But now they're putting the lights.
My room, my Twitch stream space, right? Yeah. And we got the exact same chair that my fans always see me in and all that stuff.
Now we're lighting over the walls instead of
from a performer's perspective. Yes, certainly I would rather go to a sterile space that has ample space and, you know, the director is far away, everyone's spread out and far away, and they're, like you mentioned, elephant doors. You know, elephant doors are giant doors, so you've got a lot of you know, air.
Sure, you can fit an elephant through them.
You literally can. Yeah. That, if I'm an actor from that perspective, yeah, that sounds better to me. But how many people does it take to build that set, fabricate that set, and how, like, can they all be in the same space at the same time? I don't know. Well, that sort of, those questions, I think, are a bigger issue.
I mean, building a room, you have like 3 flats, right? Or you know, depending on the dimensions, multiple flats, but you're building 3 walls. You can have 2 people more or less do the construction of that.
I guess when I just had a spot drop today, actually. My last job right before everything went, the Mountain Dew spot. Yeah, it just came out today. And that was a full set build in a soundstage. And like, we had at least 4, probably closer to like 8 construction dudes. It was a lot of manpower to get it built.
How long did they have to build it?
2 days.
It's like 8 people, but that includes dressing, painting, you had bricks, you had...
Yeah, which is all, and a breakaway wall and all of that stuff. But yeah, kind of not so far from what you're describing. It wasn't giant. It was like bigger than a regular bedroom, but not huge. We built like a loft. And look, there's features and all of that stuff. You could definitely get it done faster. And like I said, one of the walls had to be a breakaway wall. But like, if you're laying flooring and you've got a window and you've got texture on everything, and then it has to be dressed... You know, that takes a number of people, you know?
Right. Actually, kind of, our room doesn't have a window now that I think about it. But yeah, go
still,
on.
Still. It brings me to a pretty ample comparison. I am shooting pickups for the feature that we shot, like insert shots, this Monday. So less than a week from now. And the DP is going to come over and... We're just going to use some basic lights. He owns the camera and all of that stuff. But, you know, that's made me relatively nervous compared to my utterly sequestered. He's going to wear a mask and Chrissy and I are going to wear masks. Yeah.
So just to play devil's advocate, like, let's say your DP had COVID, was an asymptomatic carrier.
Mm-hmm.
And he's wearing a mask the entire time. What actors are in the scene?
None. Thank goodness. It's all inserts. It's all like...
Hands and stuff, though?
There are some hands, but it's either myself or Chrissy doing all the hand doubling.
And are you guys going to wear masks?
Yeah, of course.
I do think the masks are pretty effective and, you know, sanitize on the way in, keep the mask on, sanitize in the middle and stuff, you know, and you guys are handling most things.
Yeah.
But I do even think like a soundstage is... easier, cleaner, more breezy, bigger place, you know.
Yeah. There's less
shared air.
Yeah, shared air issue for sure. I think also surfaces are just easier to clean with the soundstage because it's a clean slate. You know, it's basically just like a giant empty room. And so, whereas the apartment, it's like there's surfaces that are going to be there forever, you know, and all of that.
Are you going to take his temperature when he walks in?
Probably not.
I wonder if there's people listening to this podcast that live like in places where they just think this whole conversation is totally ridiculous.
Yeah, totally. I think the psychological part of it that's complicated is that my wife and I have held a very, very high standard in terms of risk aversion, mostly because it's been pretty easy for us. You know, like, we don't have things in our lives that make it especially hard. It's not like I miss the beach or something like that, you know, or mm-hmm. have a child that needs to burn off a ton of energy, or a job that takes me out of the house. So we were very, very fortunate in that way. But as a result, we are less used to any potential contamination than probably most people in the world. We're kind of an absurd degree of caution thus far, and so it feels weird to break that seal.
Right.
Logically, yeah. Though, yeah, everyone's going to be fine, you know?
Yeah.
Masks and decontamination and all that stuff.
I'm like obsessed with trying to figure out how people are getting it, because I do think you can do things safely, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And I think a part of our job, because, you know, when this first started, you and I were like, there's no way on a set, like, a PA is not going to touch a trash can that someone else is going to touch, someone else is going to touch that someone, like, people are going to touch all the same stuff. But I think if you keep a mask on, so you're not touching your face, and you sanitize, and you take temperatures, and there's no one that's symptomatic on set, you could survive a shoot, even if some, like, one or two people on set had COVID.
Is it crazy for me to get drop cloth and, like, cover my stuff and then throw all the drop cloth away? Like, disposable drop cloth? That is, right?
Is it crazy? No. I mean, it's something my wife would do in an instant that I would be like... Hey folks, we're interrupting this incredible episode of the podcast to tell you about a new sponsor that we're working with, Front Row Insurance Brokers. One of the challenges of being a filmmaker is that there's a lot of risks that we take, and we really just want to focus on making good stuff. So what if there was a company that could take those risks, manage them for us while we are being artists?
That's right. Front Row Insurance Brokers arranges film production insurance to cover the risks associated with your production. They cover features, TV shows, documentaries, commercials, music videos, webisodes, basically anything you can watch on big, medium, or phone-sized screens.
Yeah, Front Row will help you focus on your artistic vision by transferring all the risks to them and minimizing your production hazards. And they cover any budget from $2,000 all the way up to $200 million. There's nothing that's too small or too big.
If you are shooting in Canada, use coupon code JUSTSHOOTIT50OFF for $50 off your film production insurance. That's promo code JUSTSHOOTIT50OFF to save $50.
And if you're shooting in the U.S., that same code can be redeemed offline by mentioning it to a broker, by email, or over the phone.
It's like a cool password if you're in the U.S. That's just shoot it 50 off.
Check them out. Let us know how it goes. How much did that drop cloth cost? Drop cloth cost?
Disposable drop cloth is pretty cheap. Like, the answer is $20 to cover literally everything you own.
Yeah, plus you have to go to Home Depot.
I'd get on Amazon. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it just depends if you think it's...
It's more genuinely, yeah. It's more for peace of mind. Like, we are already so far into the zone of rationally being safe that it's purely just that. And also, it's my home, right? So, like, it's not like I leave the soundstage and then go home and know that everything's fine. You know, we call it a wrap, and then I have to, like, decontaminate everything.
Yeah, I think so. Like, I guess the other way we could direct that we haven't quite talked about, at least on this episode yet, is, like, just directing things ourselves.
Mm-hmm. Self-shooting, you mean? Yeah.
Yeah. Us self-shooting as opposed to sending equipment to an actor to self-shoot.
Mm-hmm.
So we both live with actors, but I think I mentioned to you the other day, I had an audition for a commercial that required a dad and a daughter that was between 4 and 6, and my daughter's 4, and... they wanted someone that was a filmmaker that could also shoot, that had access to gear, could light, record sound, do all that stuff. And so we recorded this absolutely horrible audition.
Yeah. Yeah. You know what's really interesting? I've been thinking a lot about this because I have been in talks with people about shoots like this as well. And, you know, my wife's an actor, and SAG has some specific rules on all of that stuff, but it really calls into question the amount of privilege that it takes to be a working actor right now, right? Because there's like, it's already hard enough to be an actor, and most of the time you're either working additional jobs or getting some other sort of support, right? And probably both, right?
Mm-hmm.
But it's really tricky when it's like, now you also have to live with a filmmaker who owns their own gear and then live in a place that is photogenic, you know? Like, that's a lot of hoops to jump through to then book a job that, like, you know, sometimes pays great and sometimes doesn't pay very much money, you know? It's like, it's pretty bonkers to me.
Yeah, no, it sucks. Even from the filmmaker point of view, I find it a little stressful to be like, okay, so I'm doing the lighting, I'm doing this, I'm doing all these things, but then also acting, you know?
Yeah. Yeah.
And nobody is really helping you.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. All of a sudden, normally at least an actor can look to a director on Skype and they can be like, don't worry, you're doing great. I just need you to move the camera 2 inches to its left.
Yeah.
Like, having a little bit of oversight and a little bit of collaboration, I think, is really important in especially stressful situations.
Yeah. But that said, we have heard of some people being quite successful with this. I've seen a lot of directors that are doing stop motion things and even food shoots at their own homes. You know, we even have this listener, Kevin O'Brien, who shot these PSAs with for hand washing and wearing masks. And even though he did go to a few different locations and he worked with some various actors, or, you know, there are people
he's
outside
working
of
within
his...
the system, basically, right?
Yeah,
but he's still keeping his crew super lean. I think it was just him, correct? And maybe his
wife or something.
Very, very lean, with gear that he owns and people that he knew, basically.
Yeah. And so this thing that I think in Hollywood, there's this general progression where you start out by buying a camera and you're making things and you're editing things yourselves and you're teaming up with some friends and you're making shorts and you maybe went to film school or something. But at some point, the goal is that you no longer have to be the person that's like loading the C-stands in your car or setting up the lights, or, you know, you get to have a crew, a bigger crew and bigger crew and bigger crew. And that's kind of like a little bit of like the validation of being a filmmaker. Is like, hey, I'm working with 40 people right now. Like,
sure,
we're doing something that's bigger than just me.
Yeah. They could see me now. Yeah.
But all of a sudden, right now, the person that can do everything by themselves, and I don't just mean like being a DP and shooting or acting. And my friend Laura Everly, she's shoots and acts, and like, she just did, you know, a bunch of different commercials and stuff that she just shot at home that all look amazing, by the way, on a Canon 5D.
That's great. I haven't seen those, actually.
But
are they commercials that she sold herself, or?
She was hired to shoot them. Yeah.
Oh, wow. I'm not on Facebook anymore. I miss all this stuff.
Yeah. I think her situation is kind of unique in that she was kind of making periodical videos about mom stuff for a company that makes videos about mom stuff.
But to your point, working
but they were
connections to then leverage into self-shooting.
Yeah. Well, they were finding sponsors, like corporate sponsors for those things. So they are like, it's more like branded video, I guess, than a commercial. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Per se, but my point was that it's not just that. It could just be like you're animating or you're making things in Blender or like all these things that, you know, I think even I, who like love VFX and love 3D and love all the stuff, if I do a shoot that has VFX in it, we like figure out who's going to do the VFX. We're going to hire an artist or a company or a post house or someone. But all of a sudden, it's like, you got to think backwards. You got to think of like, what's the end product and how can I achieve all these things on my own?
Yeah. It's funny because I think part of it is just the validation of like, oh, now I don't have to load C stands. But also, I always joke about this on the podcast. I remember the moment when because I used to rap with the crew all the time to like show that I was a good guy. I was like there with them, like last man standing. I'm going to like be there till the bitter end. And I remember rapping a chord and like putting it down and then someone coming and redoing it.
Right.
And I was like, oh, right, now there are people who are more skilled at this who just want me out of their way so that they can do a better job. And that's kind of a version of the other part of why it's really good to have a bigger crew is that you're hiring people who are better at their job than you would be. Right. And so, like, it can be really complicated or tricky to all of a sudden be like, well, shoot, now I'm the DP again. And like, yeah, technically I can do this, but I know 20 other people who would be better at it, or at least contribute ideas that I didn't have in the first place.
Yeah. But now this jack of all trades does all of a sudden has become valuable again. Yeah. And I bet a lot of our listeners are kind of those jacks of all trades. I saw one of our, occasional guest, Jemai Youssef, she's learning Unreal. She's been doing all this 3D modeling and animation.
Oh, fun.
Recently. And, you know, I mentioned that I'd bought a PC, and PC parts are, like, almost impossible to get right now, like, really good graphics cards and processors, because everyone is buying PCs and trying to get good at 3D modeling and animation and stuff, because it really is the future, I think. Some of the stuff I've seen on Instagram and stuff of what people are doing totally by themselves makes me think, even if we could go out and shoot things, like, why would we when we could hire one or two people to build this environment?
To build something incredible. Well, let's shift into that a little bit, because you've been really talking a ton about Blender with me, and you're so excited about it. And I think that, you know, I have been really focused on my traditional career, you know. Like, I've got an indie feature that we're finishing up, and I'm writing a new one. And it's kind of like, you know, what I would be doing if I was just out of work under normal circumstances. And like we said at the top of the show, things are different now, and we know they're going to be different for a long time. And so we also have kind of been looking at, like, what's on the horizon? What makes sense? How do you make a living when you can't put a big crew together, and separate from self-shooting and all the stuff that we talked about before? I'm curious to know if your interest in Blender and VFX, or your renewed interest in VFX, is partially motivated by the idea of freelancing in that world, or what's the thinking behind it? Where is it coming from? Or is it just like a fun, positive distraction?
Well, my first job during the pandemic was a VFX job. And it made me feel good, because as everyone's shoots were being canceled, including my own, this opportunity came up to do a bunch of screen replacements for some weird Japanese vape commercial or something that I was weird as it is. And I was like, should I even be working on this? But it was like,
that's so funny. I've been vaping a ton.
Yeah.
Thanks to you.
I mean, many of Gary Larson's biggest fans are big vapers.
Big vapers, yeah.
So I was like, man, I should really get my reel together and get all this VFX work, because there's all this stuff in post. Now, by now, 4 months into it, probably not as much stuff in post, but a lot of people buying stock footage and wanting to change some of it, or doing animated things, animated projects. So I think that my motivation, which was originally like, hey, I can get jobs, has evolved quite a bit. And a big part of it was having Lawson Deming on our podcast. You know, he's the owns Barnstorm VFX, who does all the VFX for Man in the High Castle. And he was always a big proponent of Blender, which is interesting to those of you that don't know much about 3D graphics, because the industry standard for 3D graphics forever has been Maya. And then there's a few other packages like Cinema 4D, Houdini, other things that let you do certain things better. But Maya is like what they use at DreamWorks, what they use at Pixar, what they use everywhere, you know? It is the industry standard, and it's expensive, and it's hard to learn. And Blender is this 100% free software. When he was pushing for that, and it turns out they use a lot of it for Man in the High Castle, and then I just kind of dove in to see, like, well, hey, I could get my feet wet and like serious 3D software, serious enough to make Man in the High Castle for free without spending any money, like maybe I'll do it. And I just like discovered all these artists that are just doing the most insane things. And there are actually people at Pixar and DreamWorks and various places that are kind of sneaking Blender in. There's people at Marvel that are using it. And so to me, it more became this idea that maybe I'm not going to like work to become like an amazing 3D modeler, or texture, or shader, or animator, and, you know, get 30 seconds of footage in a Pixar film 10 years from now. Like, I don't see that really being my future, but I do see like, hey, maybe I can make my short film that has like 10 awesome VFX shots that I do in Blender that are like at a broad TV level. You know, they're not going to be a Marvel level, but they might be at a broadcast level of some sort, production level. And it just got me really excited from a creative like inspiration type of place. So I think that's why I'm putting everything in it. And we talked about this off the mic, but I do a lot of my storyboards in Cinema 4D, which is a 3D package. And it's really fun to figure out your shots in 3D. And now if I can transfer that over to Blender, this project I have that I don't know when it's going to shoot, but it's going to be on the stage. I think I'm going to try to create the whole thing in Blender, like as a 3D animation. And then it's like an animatic, and you know, as soon as you get better at things, like, oh, maybe now there's new smoke, fire.
Have we talked about, I think that, you remember that movie Free Fire? It's like a 70s movie with like Brie Larson and a handful of other people. It's in real time. And it's just kind of like a gunfight, basically.
Everyone's hidden.
I remember reading an article about how the director modeled it in Minecraft.
Oh, that's cool.
Just to make sure that the sight lines always worked. But it's like the low rent version of, you know.
Yeah. I mean, Unreal is also this like totally free 3D environment. It's just built so much for gaming that I find the learning curve a little bit harder. It's hard to find the tools in Unreal to do cinema as opposed to program games, you know. It's like just noisier. But anyway, so yeah, the biggest problem with Blender is there's just too many amazing things to learn, you know, from sculpting to fluids to animation to modeling to lighting. But all of them kind of play back into filmmaking in a way. And you start watching these animators like online and them talking about how like they worked on animating this character's mouth for like 2 months, you know, on Elsa's mouth so that... And you think, like, why don't you just do facial capture, you know, and just copy it? And it's because animation really is an art. And the art isn't just mimicking how a human being would do this. It's exaggerating certain poses. It's pushing the nose out. It's putting, you know, I mean, you told me you practically minored in animation. You know this. It's like animating a character is so much more than motion capture, you know?
Yeah, without a doubt. I think that most motion capture, I think, is always plussed and embellished by hand animation as well. But you know, Warren, what I kept thinking about while you were telling me this story about Blender and, you know, my own endeavors writing more and like developing out more projects, I think what I'm hearing is that we're both falling back on our core competencies and the fundamentals, right? So you're learning how to be a better filmmaker and learning new tools through computers and like visual graphics, right? Which was kind of like your original interest before you became an engineer, before, you know, like when you were just a kid, like playing with computers was the kind of the way that you figured out storytelling and filmmaking in a sense, right?
Yeah. That intersection between technology and art is like what gets me super excited.
That's your sweet spot, right? And I think that I kind of constantly have to remind myself of the writing of it all and the story fundamentals of it all. And that's kind of where I've gotten reinvigorated. And just in general, trying to figure out how to survive, right? Like post all of this, you know, like what am I going to do for the next 6 months? You know, the answer can't be watch more TV.
Yeah, they're actually out of TV.
We're scraping the barrel, man. But so I think that to listeners at home, whether you're interested in writing more or learning 3D graphics, I think sharpening those skills, I think, is going to be a thing that is going to bring you some clarity and peace and excitement, you know, because I think that's the thing that we're all dealing with. I think, you know, in months past, there was a lot of rhetoric around like being kind to yourself and not putting too much pressure on yourself and not stressing yourself out. Because a pandemic is a really stressful thing to deal with. And so don't feel bad if you haven't written the Great American Screenplay by now. And I think that is all still true. But I think especially as Angelenos, the knowledge that our lives are this way for the foreseeable future means that you have to get into some sort of gear so that you don't feel like garbage for another 8 months.
Yeah, for sure. By gear, you mean like you have to shift into a gear, right?
Shift into something. Yeah, it can't just be, you know, sourdough and YouTube yoga videos. Right. Though those are great, you know?
Yeah, and I will
shout
say
out
like...
Yoga with Adrian.
I'll say that to me, like if you think about what being a filmmaker means, if you really like focus on that maker half of that term, like writing for me is very hard. I know it's hard for everyone. I'm sure it's hard for you, but
yeah, it's still
with my daughter, with my family, with our schedule. Like I know the right thing to do is to like sit down and write a great pilot, write a feature, write all that stuff. But with the stress of the world and the news and everything, like if you feel like that's just not something you have the mental capacity to accomplish right now, just I think to me kind of the takeaway is like make something, you know, whether you're excited by technology and you're excited by stop motion stuff, you're excited by cooking and you can share that in some way. Like we're creative people. And yes, like I think maybe our favorite version of that is when we're on set with a bunch of people and filming things on cameras. But if you can't do that, find the thing that brings you joy.
Yeah.
And it doesn't, even though writing is probably the best way to do it.
I don't know. I don't think it's fair or worthwhile to say best, right? I think that's what I was getting at with the thing that is your truest self. Do you know what I mean?
Right. Like, or maybe that's the most traditional way of
using
free time as a filmmaker.
Yeah, perhaps. But I think that to your point, I think there's a really broad spectrum of different ways to develop your skills and craft, you know?
And some of those ways might even get you paid, you know, especially if you share things with people and they're like,
writing
hey.
Can get you paid as well. Don't forget. But yeah.
Yes, for sure. Writing a feature right now, I think it's harder to see how you turn that into money before the pandemic is over.
Before we can.
But maybe
anything,
you could. Yeah.
It depends on where you are and all of that. The thing that I've been working on as my back burner project is I have really been actively noodling, like pre-development on a scripted podcast because, you know, like you were doing, it's something where you're like, you don't really have to ask for permission. You know, we know a ton of great performers, a ton of stand-up comedians probably have their own podcast already and therefore have their own recording gear. There's a lot of, you know, smart producing reasons why doing a scripted podcast makes a ton of sense. But the flip side is I've worked so hard to write visually and train myself to figure out how to, like, do things with less and less. Dialogue is the thing that comes the most naturally to me. And I really have worked so hard sinking my teeth into figuring out how to write visually. And like early in my directing career, I really kind of tried to focus on that work as much as I could. And now it just feels like a tool that's no longer in my box. And it really
has been
an early challenge.
I think just from like kind of having gone through it one time, I think that writing sonically is a similar, albeit slightly different skill. And I feel strongly about this just because we did not do a good job of it on our podcast. We did not think about the sound of a place and how it drives the story forward in a non-dialogue, in a subtextual sense, you know, or a contextual sense. And if I had to do at least my scripted podcast all over again, I would think of interesting sounds that can kind of bring me into a scene. And like, this takes place in a forest, like what animals and what, and like, even if there's a way to tie them somehow into the plot, it would be really, it's cool. And I've listened to some podcasts that do a really great job of integrating sound into their story in a non-gimmicky way. There's a lot of gimmicky versions too. And it's kind of similar. It's more challenging, obviously.
Yeah, that's interesting. That's a great way to think of it. And I think that the thing that I think about last tends to be sound as a traditional filmmaker. And so this poses like a nice opportunity to sharpen that skill.
Yeah. What I find now that when I think about podcast scenes, it's like, how can we make a scene feel dynamic, audio wise? And to me, like, mm-hmm. dynamic obviously means like has a lot of like some loud elements and some quiet elements. And so, like, we had a scene of this girl talking on a phone in my podcast, and we just changed it to her going to someone's cheerleading practice. Like mm-hmm. it, originally she was walking on the sidewalk talking on the phone. Now she's like at a cheerleading practice while she's on the phone. So mm-hmm. she has to yell into the phone, and we hear all these cheerleaders in the background, and it just changes the whole intensity of the scene, you know? Yeah, and then when we cut great. Out of that scene, it's quiet. She's in a room. We hear some crickets or whatever. And it's like a different feeling. It's a much yeah. bigger, better transition than before when she's like walking in the neighborhood, and there's dogs and lawnmowers and some light traffic. Right.
There's no contrast between things. Or yeah, that's great. That's great. So cool, man. Well, I can't wait to hear it. And I can't wait to watch all of your weird blender experiments on Instagram.
I can't wait for my family to be like, I don't get this.
What? are you... you're looking for work, though, right, Warren?
Yeah, yeah. How is this relevant to anything? Yeah, that's my family. Well... Speaking of things that might or might not be relevant to you, are you interested in hanging out with me for some unpaid endorsements?
Let's do it, Oren.
Unpaid endorsements.
I have one.
Kick it off.
That I'm excited about. It's a new show on Disney Plus. Do you have Disney Plus?
I have my sister-in-law's account.
Okay, did you watch Hamilton?
That's the only thing we've used it for. And it was great.
Have you seen Frozen 2?
The rumors are true. No, eventually I'll see it. I like the first one. I just haven't bothered.
Well, so there is a docuseries on Disney Plus called Into the Unknown, mm-hmm. and it is the behind the scenes of Frozen 2, and I was watching it with my daughter, and I was like literally so emotional. I was like teary-eyed watching it, because, I don't know, it was just like this beautiful, like you watch the director... she comes from a writing background, Jennifer Lee, and she's co-directs it with Chris Buck, who comes from an animation background. And you just see how much work goes into these movies. Like, we all know that these Disney and mm-hmm. Pixar movies take so much work, but like the emotional work. And you know, everyone, I think most people know this, but it's just cool to see it because they have it all on video. It's like they screen the entire movie in storyboard form to mm-hmm. every other director of every other movie, like the director of Moana, the director of,
Tiana, brain trust.
This guy did The Little Mermaid, and this woman did Brave or whatever. Like, yeah, and they come and they watch and they give you notes, and then you just see them like when they're recording the music with an orchestra, and you see Idina Menzel comes and meets one of the animators to just look at this shot. And by the way, an animator, I kind of touched on this earlier, but. And this is where I got this from. They will work on a movie for a year, and they will have between like a minute and a minute and a half of movie that is there. So when they're watching it with their family, they're like, yep, I did that two-second shot. Yeah. So there's this amazing scene where they do this animation review. We see this animator. She's kind of a newer animator, junior animator, and she's doing this shot of Elsa running to the edge of a cliff and stopping. And they show her... working on it, and she's so nervous. And then they go and they have this whole animation review where it's just that one shot with 50 people in a movie theater watching it. And then they all watch it, and then they're all like nodding, okay. And the director, Jennifer Lee, she's like, it's pretty good. But she seems kind of like hesitant, like when she's running, like how can we get her to feel more confident? What if she runs and slides, like almost like an ice skater? And then it's like, it's just crazy, like how many people are involved in one detail of one body movement.
That's 15 seconds worth of footage.
Oh, less. Yeah. It's crazy. And
you
just
know, there's
seeing...
that famous story that maybe I've told on the podcast where they back in the day before when they would do hand drawn animation.
Is this Who Framed Roger Rabbit?
No, Little Mermaid. So Jeffrey Katzenberg is like a relatively new, young, fancy executive. And they're showing like basically an animatic of The Little Mermaid to a theater of like animators' kids, I think mostly. And Under the Sea comes on, and a kid drops their popcorn and like has like a little tantrum about it. And Katzenberg wanted to cut Under the Sea because
of
it. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, no, that's crazy.
He was like, no, this song isn't working. We should cut it.
It's a very good song.
So I actually have an endorsement that I think really, it's a show that I've endorsed many times before, but I can't get enough of it. The show Imaginary Worlds. It's a podcast about basically sci-fi and fandom, basically.
Yeah, I think when I listened to that, the whoomp, the sound effect one. You
sound effect one. It's great, right? Yeah, that one is really, really
wonderful.
What's
that one called? The whoomp?
Yeah, the womp, maybe?
The womp.
The wah, I think. Which is a reference to, like, the Chris Nolan, like, Inception wah.
Yeah.
And the whole trailer craft, basically. But episode 147, the Once in Future Comic Con, I found really therapeutic. It's basically an episode about the history and importance of fan conventions and the fact that we won't be able to attend them this year. San Diego Comic Con, which is kind of the big mothership, is doing an online one. I think a lot of other ones will be following suit. And the kind of economic fallout of conventions not being a thing for people anymore. But, you know, summer is convention season. And while I am only a moderate nerd, I have gone to San Diego. Compared to, like, real nerds, I'm, like, a lightweight. Compared to normal people, I'm a big nerd. I'm just kind of right in that middle spot. So I've gone to Comic-Con for the last decade. And I've always really loved it. And it makes me sad that I don't have the choice. I probably wasn't going to go this year, but it makes me sad that I don't have the option to. And well, so this was a little
it's good.
Nice to
now you
to.
Can say you've gone to every Comic-Con you could have gone to.
I skipped one. I missed one for Townies, actually, now that I think
of
it.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Never mind.
If you are craving a convention experience or even, like, you know, state fairs, outdoor movie screenings, all of that stuff kind of that we associate with summer has changed pretty drastically for us. And so this was a little piece of nostalgia for me. So seek out that thing that you miss and maybe acknowledging it and thinking about it and processing it will be helpful.
Cool. Thanks for the rec, Matt. If you guys have any recommendations or questions or want to just say anything about anything, we'd love to hear from you. We want to hear about your COVID directing. We'd like to hear.
Yeah, I actually, on the Stefan Dezel episode that just came out, somebody recommended other soundtracks to write to. And I thought, boy, that's great. So chime in with your endorsements or your thoughts on the things that we endorsed. And maybe we'll get a little conversation going.
Cool. Are you talking about Dre Babinski's recommendations?
No. I'm talking about somebody totally different.
She
whose
just
name I did
us.
Not recognize. Did she really?
Yeah.
Like about, a second ago?
Minutes ago. About soundtracks to write to.
Really? Oh, what a...
Yes.
All right. Well, so then now we have to start a thread of soundtracks to write to. So check that out on our Facebook and Instagram. And pile on if you have an endorsement that you want to throw into the pile.
Endorse away. This episode was edited by Jay McAuliffe. Our webmaster is Ewan Williams. The music you're listening to is from the Free Music Archive and the artist Jazar. And thanks for listening. We will catch
you
next
everyone.
Week.
Bye.
Bye.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.